Their Eyes Were Watching God stands as one of the most influential novels in American literature, a cornerstone of both the Harlem Renaissance and feminist literature. Published in 1937, Zora Neale Hurston's masterpiece was initially met with criticism from male contemporaries like Richard Wright, who dismissed its focus on a Black woman's emotional journey rather than racial politics. Yet time has vindicated Hurston's vision. Oprah Winfrey produced a film adaptation starring Halle Berry, and the novel appears on countless must-read lists. Alice Walker led its rediscovery in the 1970s, recognizing its revolutionary portrayal of a Black woman's quest for self-fulfillment. Through lyrical prose that masterfully blends standard English with authentic African-American dialect, Hurston created a timeless exploration of identity, love, and personal freedom that continues to resonate with readers across generations. Ships at a distance carry every man's wish on the horizon, floating like ethereal promises against the endless sky. For men, these dreams remain forever out of reach, creating lives of quiet resignation, their hopes dissolving like morning mist. But women, they forget their wishes and remember what truly matters, transforming their dreams into tangible realities. For them, dreams are truth, and they act accordingly, weaving their aspirations into the fabric of their daily lives. When Janie returns to Eatonville wearing muddy overalls, her long black hair flowing freely down her back like a defiant banner, instead of tied up as expected of a middle-aged widow, the townspeople's judgment is immediate and harsh. The sight of her challenges their rigid social expectations, particularly for a woman of her standing. They sit on their porches at sundown, transformed from daily laborers, field workers, washerwomen, and craftsmen into lords of sounds and lesser things, wielding words as killing tools against her. The men notice her still firm buttocks and pugnacious breasts with a mixture of desire and disapproval, while the women store away the memory of her dirty clothes like precious ammunition, a weapon against her strength, to be deployed in future conversations. Only Phoebe Watson, Janie's loyal friend of two decades, defends her against the venomous gossip that spreads through the town like wildfire. She brings Janie a plate of mulatto rice, seasoned with friendship and understanding, entering through the intimate back gate rather than the formal front entrance, a gesture that speaks volumes about their close relationship. Finding Janie soaking her tired feet on the back porch, they exchange warm greetings that carry the weight of shared history and mutual understanding. When Phoebe mentions the town gossip, Janie dismisses it with the wisdom of experience, saying, "Mouth Almighty is still sitting in the same place," acknowledging how little the town's attitudes have changed. Phoebe urges Janie to explain about tea cake, her money, and why she's returned in overalls questions that echo the town's burning curiosity. Janie reveals she still has $900 in the bank, a substantial sum that proves her financial independence, and tea cake didn't waste her money or leave her for a younger woman, as the gossips suggest. He's simply gone. The word hangs heavy with unspoken meaning between them. As darkness deepens around them like a protective curtain, Janie settles in to tell her whole story, addressing Phoebe as her kissin' friend of 20 years, a term that encompasses their deep bond of trust and affection. And so begins Janie's remarkable tale of self-discovery, a journey that will challenge everything the town thinks it knows about love, independence, and a woman's place in the world. Janie's story begins with her grandmother, Nanny, a former slave whose experiences during slavery and its aftermath shaped her fierce determination to protect her granddaughter. After Janie's mother, Leafy, was brutally raped by her schoolteacher and fled, leaving behind her infant daughter, Nanny took on the responsibility of raising Janie with an ironclad resolve to shield her from the harsh realities she had witnessed. "De nigger woman is de mule of the world," Nanny repeatedly told Janie, drawing from her own painful history to explain why security must take precedence over romantic notions of love. The contrast between Nanny's pragmatic worldview and Janie's awakening sexuality creates the central tension of her early life. When 16-year-old Janie experiences her sexual awakening beneath a blossoming pear tree, the scene becomes a powerful metaphor for her budding desires. Watching bees pollinate flowers in the garden, she witnesses nature's intimate dance of creation, which sparks her own dreams of passionate love. This pivotal moment represents everything Nanny fears: unbridled desire that could lead to vulnerability and pain. Nanny's intervention comes swiftly when she catches Janie kissing Johnny Taylor over the gatepost. This innocent display of affection triggers Nanny's deepest fears, prompting her to arrange Janie's marriage to Logan Killix, a much older man who offers material security through his 60 acres of land and established homestead. Though Janie protests vehemently, expressing her revulsion at the idea of marrying a man she doesn't love, Nanny remains unmoved, believing that respectability and financial security will protect Janie from the degradation she herself endured. Through raw, emotionally charged dialogue, Nanny reveals the depth of her own sacrificed dreams. "Ah, was born back due in slavery, so it wasn't for me to fulfill my dreams. But nothing can't stop you from wishing. You can't beat nobody down so low till you can rob them of they will." The bitter irony lies in how Nanny, in her desperate attempt to protect Janie, becomes the very force that constrains her granddaughter's spirit, effectively clipping her wings before she can truly fly. In their final interaction before Nanny's death, she pleads with Janie, "Put me down easy, Janie. I'm a cracked plate." This poignant metaphor reveals Nanny's awareness of her own brokenness, shaped by trauma and survival. Years later, Janie would come to understand how Nanny had pinched the horizon into such a little bit of a thing, not out of malice, but out of love, filtered through fear and generational trauma. This realization marks the beginning of Janie's complex journey to expand her horizon back to its full breadth, a quest that would define her life's trajectory and her search for authentic love and self-fulfillment. There are years that ask questions and years that answer. Janie's marriage to Logan Killix posed only questions. Would marriage end cosmic loneliness? Would it compel love like the sun compels the day? The answers proved disappointing. Though Logan provided material security, he never awakened the feelings Janie had experienced beneath the pear tree. After 3 months of marriage, Janie visited Nanny, confessing she didn't love Logan despite his 60 acres. "Ah wants to want him sometimes," she explained. "Ah don't want him to do all the wantin'." But Nanny dismissed her concerns, insisting Janie's mind would change with time. When Logan began treating Janie like a farmhand, demanding she help with manure piles and threatening violence, something shifted within her. The arrival of Joe Stark's handsome, ambitious, and full of dreams offered an escape. Joe spoke of building a new all-black town where he would become a big voice. His vision captivated Janie, who saw in him the possibility of love and adventure. Without hesitation, Janie left Logan, walking away from her apron and her loveless marriage. She and Joe were married before sundown in Green Cove Springs, with new clothes of silk and wool, watching the sun plunge into the same crack from which night emerged. Janie believed she was finally moving toward her horizon, toward the love she'd been seeking since that moment beneath the pear tree. But Joe's vision didn't include Janie as an equal partner. As he built Eatonville into a thriving town, becoming its mayor and most prominent citizen, he positioned Janie as a trophy, the mayor's wife who must be kept separate from common folk. "Use Mrs. Mayor Starks," he reminded her whenever she tried to join the lively conversations on the store porch. He insisted she wear a head rag to hide her beautiful hair from other men's eyes, though he never explained his jealousy. For 20 years, Janie lived in Joe's shadow, running the store while he handled mayoral duties. She learned how to talk some and leave some, developing a strange dissociation where her true self sat under a shady tree with the wind blowing through her hair, while her shadow self tended the store and prostrated before Joe. This psychological splitting became like a drug that helped her endure, making her receive all things with the stolidness of the earth which soaks up urine and perfume with the same indifference. As the years passed, Joe's body began to fail him. His once intimidating belly sagged like a load suspended from his loins, and his eyes grew a little absent. Perhaps to compensate for his physical decline, Joe became increasingly cruel, constantly reminding Janie of her age. "You ain't no young pullet no mo. You's a old hen now." The breaking point came when Joe humiliated Janie in the store after she cut a plug of tobacco incorrectly. For the first time, Janie stood her ground, publicly emasculating him. "When you pull down your britches, you look like to change your life." This confrontation shattered Joe's illusion of irresistible maleness and marked a turning point in their relationship. Joe moved downstairs to sleep separately from Janie, and their household settled into the stillness that was the sleep of swords. As Joe's health deteriorated further, he consulted with a root doctor while refusing Janie's attempts to care for him. In their final confrontation, Janie spoke painful truths. "You wasn't satisfied with me the way I was. You got to pacify somebody besides yourself if you wants any love and any sympathy in this world." Joe died during this conversation, his hands frozen in agonizing protest. For the first time in years, Janie felt pity for Joe, wondering if she might have made his face different if she'd known another way. Looking in the mirror after his death, she found that though the young girl was gone, a handsome woman had taken her place. Joe's funeral was magnificent, the finest thing Orange County had ever seen with Negro eyes. But behind her veil, Janie's face was like a wall of stone and steel, while inwardly she was rollicking with the springtime across the world. After Joe's death, Janie made subtle but significant changes, burning her head rags and wearing her hair in one thick braid below her waist. Though surrounded by suitors after her 6 months of mourning, she enjoyed her newfound freedom too much to seriously consider them. When Phoebe worried about appearances, Janie replied, "To my thinking, mourning oughtn't to last no longer in grief." Everything changed when Virgible Teacake Woods walked into the store one day. 12 years younger than 40-year-old Janie, Teacake was playful, charming, and utterly unlike the serious men she'd known before. Their first meeting turned into a playful checkers game that ended with them laughing as they scrambled for fallen pieces. Teacake's spontaneous pantomimes and genuine warmth broke through Janie's defenses, and though she briefly worried about his intentions, the fear quickly passed as Teacake wasn't strange. Seemed as if she had known him all her life. Despite her attempts to resist her attraction to this younger man, Janie found herself drawn to Teacake, who looked like the love thoughts of women. He could be a bee to a blossom, a pear tree blossom in the spring. When he disappeared for days, doubt tortured her, but he returned with a car, inviting her to the Sunday school picnic and dismissing her concerns with, "Nobody else on earth can hold a candle to you, baby. You got the keys to the kingdom." The town disapproved of their relationship. Just 9 months after Joe's death, Janie was wearing pink linen and high-heeled slippers, looking like some young girl. But Janie had stopped living for others' approval. When Phoebe warned her about Teacake possibly wanting her money, Janie responded, "This ain't no business proposition, and no race after property and titles. This is a love game. Ah, done lived grandma's way. Now ah means still life mine." Teacake took Janie to Jacksonville, where they married immediately, then to the Everglades DeMuck, where they could work together during bean picking season. The Everglades overwhelmed with its vastness. Big Lake Okeechobee, towering weeds, wild cane, and soil so rich that everything grew uncontrollably. While Teacake planted beans, Janie made their shack a home. After work, they fished and occasionally encountered Indians in dugouts navigating the glades. Teacake taught Janie to shoot, and she became remarkably skilled, even better than him. They'd hunt together, bringing home game and sometimes alligators whose hides they sold in Palm Beach. Unlike her silent years at the store, here Janie could join the men's boisterous storytelling and big arguments, enjoying the laughter and camaraderie. Their home became the unofficial center of the community, filled with people every night, some for Teacake's music, others for gambling and storytelling. Janie sometimes thought of Eatonville and laughed at what people there would think of her now in overalls, hosting dice games. Their relationship wasn't without challenges. When Janie caught Teacake with a young woman named Nunky in the cane field, jealousy erupted into rage. Though Teacake claimed Nunky had stolen his work tickets, Janie's suspicions flared. At home, they fought fiercely until their struggle transformed into passionate lovemaking. The next morning, Teacake reassured her, "What would I do with dat lil chunk of a woman with you around? She ain't good for nothing except to set up in a corner by the kitchen stove and break wood over her head. Use something to make a man forget to get old and forget to die." Their love was tested further by Mrs. Turner, a light-skinned black woman who disapproved of Janie's marriage to the darker-skinned Teacake. Mrs. Turner's attempts to set Janie up with her brother triggered Teacake's insecurities, leading him to slap Janie to show he was boss. Though this possessive violence was problematic, Janie understood it as an expression of his fear of losing her, and their relationship quickly recovered. The seasonal workers' peaceful existence on the Muck was disrupted when Seminole Indians began fleeing the Everglades, carrying ancient wisdom about weather patterns. They moved with quiet urgency through the settlements, warning of an impending hurricane with a gravity that spoke of generations of experience. Most residents, accustomed to Florida's frequent storms and confident in their sturdy homes, dismissed these warnings as unnecessary caution, continuing their daily routines in the fertile farmland. The atmosphere changed dramatically when the first bands of wind and rain arrived. The sky darkened to an ominous green-black, and the wind began its haunting howl, building from a whisper to a scream. As the storm intensified, Teacake and Janie found themselves trapped in their cabin, watching helplessly as water crept under their door and rose inch by inch. The walls groaned under the storm's assault and the roof shuddered with each gust. When the cabin finally gave way, splintering like matchwood, they were forced into the maelstrom. The wind threw debris through the air like missiles, and the rain fell so hard it felt like needles on their skin. Janie, thinking quickly, grabbed a piece of fallen roofing to shield Teacake, but the hurricane had other plans. A massive gust caught the makeshift shield like a sail, lifting Janie clean off her feet and hurling her into the churning floodwaters. As she fought against the current, Teacake spotted something extraordinary, a cow swimming steadily through the chaos with a large dog perched on its back. He shouted to Janie above the storm's roar, directing her to grab the cow's tail. She managed to grasp it, pulling herself along the animal's body until she could climb onto its broad back. The dog, already terrified and aggressive, turned on her with savage fury. Its eyes gleamed with panic and rage, teeth bared in a snarl that promised death. Teacake, without hesitation, plunged into the roiling water. Armed only with his pocket knife, he engaged in a desperate struggle with the powerful animal. The dog's jaws found their mark on Teacake's cheekbone before he could drive his blade home, ending the threat. The bite seemed minor in the moment, a small price for survival. Later, as they huddled together on higher ground, Teacake tried to make light of his injury. He'd raised hell, though, if he had grabbed me an inch higher and bit me in my eye. You can't buy eyes in a store, you know. His attempt at humor masked the gravity of what had occurred. Neither he nor Janie could have imagined that this seemingly minor wound would prove to be their greatest tragedy, carrying within it a death sentence more certain than the hurricane they had just survived. The dog's bite carried rabies, and Teacake's illness progressed rapidly. When Janie tried giving him water, he gagged horribly, claiming, "That water is something wrong with it." Dr. Simmons delivered the devastating diagnosis and suggested the county hospital, where they could restrain Teacake, but Janie refused. "Ah, can't stand the idea of tying Teacake like he was a mad dog." As the disease advanced, Teacake became paranoid and jealous, keeping a pistol under his pillow. When Janie prepared to get the doctor at dawn, Teacake became enraged and confronted her with the gun. Their weapons fired almost simultaneously. Teacake's bullet buried itself in the joist over Janie's head, while Janie's shot struck true. Teacake crumpled forward into her arms, biting into her forearm as he died. Janie was arrested and tried that same day. The courtroom was packed with hostile onlookers, but Dr. Simmons testified about Teacake's rabies and the danger he posed. When Janie took the stand, she spoke plainly, making them understand she could never shoot Teacake out of malice, and how he had to die to get rid of the dog. The jury deliberated just 5 minutes before declaring the death of Virgil Woods to be entirely accidental and justifiable. After burying Teacake with a new guitar in his hands, Janie returned to Eatonville. Back home with Phoebe, she shared her hard-won wisdom. "Love ain't something lack a grindstone, dat's the same thing everywhere. Love is lack to see. It's a moving thing, but still in all, it takes its shape from the shore it meets." She explained that you got to go there to know there, that living must be experienced firsthand. Alone in her room that night, memories of Teacake came to Janie not as sorrow, but as pictures of love and light against the wall. The day of the gun and the bloody body sang a sobbing sigh that filled the room until Teacake came prancing around her and the sigh flew out the window. These memories, rather than haunting her, served as testaments to the depth of love she had experienced and the strength she had found within herself to endure its loss. Teacake, with the sun for a shawl, could never be dead until she finished feeling and thinking. His spirit remained vibrant in her consciousness, not as a ghost that tormented her, but as an enduring presence that had transformed her understanding of love and life. Here was peace, not the passive peace of resignation, but the active peace of someone who had lived fully and loved deeply. She pulled in her horizon like a great fishnet from around the waist of the world and draped it over her shoulder, calling in her soul to come and see all the life in its meshes. Within these metaphorical nets lay the entirety of her journey, the sweet scent of blossoms beneath the pear tree, the stifling silence of her years with Logan Killix, the false glamour of life with Jodi Starks, and the liberating love she found with Teacake. Through three marriages and countless trials, Janie had finally found what she sought beneath the pear tree all those years ago, not in a man, but in herself. Her evolution from obedient granddaughter to trophy wife to equal partner had led her to self-ownership. Each relationship had taught her something essential. Logan showed her what she didn't want, Jodi revealed the price of silence, and Teacake helped her discover her own voice. By loving Teacake fully and freely, she had discovered her own capacity for joy, passion, and resilience. Hurston's masterpiece ends not with Janie defined by her relationship to a man, but with Janie complete in herself, gathering her experiences like treasures in a net. The horizon that Nanny had once pinched into such a little bit of a thing now belonged to Janie entirely, not as something distant to be reached, but as something to be gathered close, examined, and cherished. This horizon represented not just possibilities, but the sum of all she had lived through and learned from. Her grandmother's limited vision of security through marriage had given way to Janie's broader understanding of self-fulfillment and personal autonomy. In finding her voice and telling her story to Phoebe, Janie Crawford had achieved what few literary heroines of her era were permitted, the freedom to define herself on her own terms. Her narrative became not just a love story, but a testament to female empowerment and self-discovery in a world that rarely allowed Black women either. The peace she found came not from conforming to others' expectations, but from embracing her own truth and experiences, however painful or joyous they might have been.